All your cooks were Canadian trained, and you were on the RN Vittling standard, and that brought its own problems with it.
We had another problem, which affected morale. Most of the RN people were petty officers or leading seamen, and we had them in the communication with the odd chief, not very many chiefs, mostly POs. The communicators were all RN, and some of the engine room, not all of them. They were on RN rates of pay, and a PO got less than a Canadian able seaman. That caused dissension. And then we had a NAFI canteen, which again was something that Canadians were not accustomed to. And one of the things that NAFI would not countenance was Coca-Cola, which Canadians are rather keen on. They had things called cordials, which they sold for tuppence or something, but nobody ever wanted any. And they only sold English cigarettes and nutty bars and things like that. So there was a grumble developing there from the Canadians. Then, when we were in Alameda, the Americans said, "Now look, you fellows, we've given you the ship. You can have anything. We'll send you roasts of beef and steaks and oranges and grapefruit and orange juice and everything else." We weren't allowed to use it. This irritated the troops. We left San Francisco and sailed south. And the first aircraft we flew off was quite spectacular. We were escorted by a destroyer, an old four-stacker, and a blimp. The first aircraft revved up, and again everybody was topside to see the excitement. And he went thundering down the... he wasn't using the catapult. It was a good breeze. Thundering down the flight deck. And just as he got to the bow, his engine conked and plonk, he fell in the sea. And I happened to be on the port side, and I looked over the side, and there was the aircraft. We were still steaming at full speed, sifting down the side, with the pilot standing just outside his cockpit waving to everybody. And he slipped astern. The blimp did a nosedive, quite spectacular, and dropped a rubber raft. And this young pilot, who was he was an RN. I don't think he was a New Zealander. We hadn't had much time to get to know these fellows. He walked out on the wing. Aircraft was still floating. Jumped neatly into the raft, didn't even get his feet wet. Well, then the destroyer launched lowered a motor whaler and went over, and the first thing they did when they went alongside was to upset the raft, and the fella got all wet. But anyway, we lost the aircraft, but we rescued the pilot. Well, then we stopped in San Diego. And we were there for a short time. I don't remember very much about San Diego. I don't think I got ashore very much there. But again, we were offered all the luscious things the Americans eat, ice cream. Oh, we couldn't have that. And then we headed down the coast of lower, Southern California, Baja California, and headed for... Panama. We were joined by the New Waterford, which had just commissioned in Esquimalt and was on her way to join the Atlantic escort forces. So she accompanied us, and we did quite a bit of flying. The only problem was we kept busting up the aircraft. They either crashed into the barrier or ran into each other or something. We didn't lose any pilots, but we bust a lot of aircraft. We got to the Panama Canal, and we went through. Oh, my goodness, aren't you kindness itself?
Tea.
How are you, Alma? That's very
fine,
nice.
Fine, thank you. Charles, and you?
Well, talking, as usual.
That sounds very jovial down here.
Yeah, this is hilarious.
Have you stopped, please?
No, let's keep tea on.
Okay.
Would you like some cheese and crackers? Or?
No, that's fine for me, thanks.
You would? Mm. Okay, would you pour the tea on now?
Thanks, Alma. You're very sweet. We had one unfortunate incident going through the canal. Naturally, it was quite an experience for all the young Canadians who were on board. Probably never done it before. And one of them was in one of the 5-inch gun sponsons, which was the starboard one, and at the stern. And somebody, inadvertently, I think, turned the training lever on, and it was power trained, and this fellow was crushed, his pelvis broken. We had a certain amount of crisis to get him off in the hospital. Well, then we went through to Kwan, and as I recall, we didn't stop. And we headed up for Norfolk, Virginia. It was very hot. The ship was very hot. And we were having our problems with food, the lack of it. And the pay question was irritating people. The business of the XO and the first lieutenant liking each other was also fermenting, and there were a few problems. When we were headed up through the Windward Passage, we were flying our own AS patrols. And one of our aircraft sighted a submarine, a German one, allegedly, and sent back a message. And just before that, they had piped, hands fall in, you know, carry on working. And nobody fell in. And what it was is that the Canadians had decided to express their little egos, and they weren't going to play. However, when the aircraft sighting message came in, captain got on the blower and said, action stations, this is not a drill.
Yes.
And the troops did come out. But there was a lot of, inquiring and what was the problem. And the problems were the food. I might say the submarine never came any closer if it was a submarine, but...
You had five problems. You had, your Canadians were, a lot of them were birds. A Canadian AB was getting paid more than an RNPO, who was getting, then you had T-124s on board.
Well, no, we got rid of them.
You got rid of the T-124Xs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. How'd you do that?
Canadians relieved them.
Oh, okay. Because you had about 5 rates of pay, rotten food for the Canadians. That was, and then there's the unfortunate grounding, the losing of the aircraft. Really, it must have been a very difficult time for the captain.
I'm only beginning, too.
Okay, well, go on.
We got to Norfolk, And we'd had various consultations. I'd talked to Lay a lot about my problem. And he went to Washington to see the head of the British Admiralty Mission, who was, he comments on it in his book, the fellow had gout or something.
Yeah.
And then he went to Ottawa. The USN laid on an aircraft for him, and he went up and told the powers that be in Ottawa that they better remove the digit and do something. And he wanted the ship commissioned as HMCS, but this was obviously not on because the government was, and particularly, I guess, Mackenzie King, was particularly keen not to accept Lend-Lease. Mm. So the ship had to stay RN, but Canada undertook to pay the cost of victualling and to put the Canadian, that put the RN seaman branches or on Canadian rates of pay. But we couldn't include the Fleet Air Arm because we had no equivalent rates. We didn't have Fleet Air Arm. So we were able to get that straightened out, and of course the Canadian rations were more generous than the RN rations, so that solved a problem. I was £400 in debt to the Admiralty on the victualling when we got to Norfolk. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do about it. I might say I've never heard since.
I'm glad you didn't pay it.
We also, by then, needed a whole new outfit of aircraft, which were delivered on board. And we still had the original air crew. And Rowley Harris was removed, and Frank Smith was removed. And Ron Jackson, who had been in Naden, was shipped out, and he was I knew him, of course, but he was a tremendous success as the executive officer, mm-hmm. and he had his wits about him. It's true, he'd commanded a ship before, he had one of the bangers, but he was a very different cup of tea, and he brought some happiness to the ship.
Well, Nelson Lay told me, he brought a lot of happiness to the ship too, because he told me this in his farm in Balderson, where I used to visit him a lot. He said, the Admiralton in Washington, this is the one with gout, I don't know if he put this in his book or not, so I'll get it on record here. He said, we'll have to put the RN, you RN chaps, on Canadian victualling. We'll have to do that. We'll have to have Canadian victualling.
We'll have to put the whole ship on
Canadian victualling. And we'll have to put the RN on Canadian rates of pay. And the admiral with a gout said, I don't think that's possible. He said, well, in that case, you've got a problem because you're going to be short a captain, too.
He put his
career on the line.
Yep.
He said, you're going to have to find another captain. He said, I propose I fly to Ottawa. And I don't want to quote what he said in Ottawa, but if I know Nelson Lay, I know what he said, and he got his way.
Yeah.
He got Canadian rates of pay for everybody on board, Canadians and RN, and he got Canadian victualling, except the Fleet Air.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted that on record in case he didn't put it in front of his book. I edited that book with him for 7 months, and I can't bear it. And Alma retyped many of the chapters.
Is that right?
Yeah. And I just can't bear to go through it again. He sent me that copy that you see up there.
Oh,
but,
yes.
But I've been through every sentence of it. So I accepted the copy with gratitude, but I don't want to read it again.
Well, I found it.
I accepted the copy with gratitude, but I don't want to read it again.
One of the problems with Nelson Lay was that he had a great tendency to put his foot in it. He was always making speeches to the ship's company, and he had an unhappy faculty of saying the wrong thing. Now, I say this in all charity because I'm a great admirer of Nelson Lay. He's got untold guts. He knows what's right, knows how things should be done. But in those days, he was not as mellow as he has since become. And sometimes he did things which were tactless, and they used to rile the troops. However, he wasn't the only one who did that.
No.
But I always got on very well with them, and, you know, I don't know whether this is a good thing or not, but...
No, but he was brought up, he was that generation who did their sub-lieutenant's time, their midshipman and their sub-lieutenant's time in the RN battleships.
That's right.
And they were brought up, this is the relationship between officers and men. And it works in the RN. With the... It might have worked in the RCN with RCN permanent force ratings, but it sure as hell didn't work with the RCNVR. And I only comment on that to put in perspective your remark that he riled the troops. That whole generation were brought up that way, and it did cause difficulties. Pugsley makes too much of them in his book, but it did cause difficulties. And we had to change a lot of things, some things we learned early and some things we learned late. For instance, Chilly Manfield told me that one of the things he resented most when he joined as an ordinary seaman, he was made an officer's servant.
Oh, yeah.
That was considered a cushy job in the
yes,
RN.
It was.
But he didn't like to be called anybody's servant.
No.
And Canadians didn't. And
you're quite right.
We changed it to cabin hand.
Yeah.
And then everybody wanted the job.
Yeah.
You were down out of the weather. That's just an example.
Yeah.
I've gone on at far too much length for an interviewer, but this is important to understand Nelson Lay's difficulties.
Oh, yes. And as I say, I'm not faulting him one little
bit. I know, and neither am I. I feel the same affection towards him.
No, you go ahead. I'll have some after you. From Norfolk, we went to New York, and we went alongside in Staten Island, and we embarked 50 Mustang aircraft for the RAF. Now, that meant that we had to strike our own aircraft into the hangar,
mm-hmm.
and the Mustangs, P-51Ds, were carried as deck cargo,
yeah.
which meant that we were going to cross the happy old Atlantic.
Helpless.
Well, non-operational.
Yeah.
We sailed in a convoy. I don't recall off the top of my head the designation of it. It was a very big one.
Got a date? Or about?
No, it's in that paper I wrote on Nabob. But
okay. Well, here then.
I wrote a screed for the Maritime Museum Bulletin.
I'll get that.
I have a copy of it at home if you want. But
well, I'll get a Xerox of it if you'll lend it to me.
Okay. I guess we were into late March by then. Our escort was very large. I think we had 13 destroyers, all USN, and a cruiser. I seem to remember it was one of the four stackers, the Cincinnati or something like that. But we were right in the middle of the convoy. It was a troop convoy and material and goodness knows what, a big convoy. And we wandered across the Atlantic in a rather devious way. I don't...
Goodbye, dear.
I don't know whether they made actual contacts. There was more than one occasion when we heard depth charges going off. But the thing that struck me on that was the fact that this was a totally USN escort, and they chattered on the TBS the whole time. They never shut up.
No.
Night and day.
Mm. It's amazing you weren't attacked more heavily.
And I know Lay was shocked by it, but I remember this very well. We were also on the trip back to England. We sailed for Liverpool. We took a whole bunch of people who had been refugees, children and wives. One wife was very pregnant, and at some point she and one of our stewards got together in the bunk, which caused a slight tremor around the place. The children were put into the custody of the chaplain, who was Bill Hills, a Church of England fellow, came from Victoria here. And the children were all over the ship. I had a taste of it. My cabin was level below the hangar deck, and just outside in a flat with a ladder going up to the hangar deck through a hatch was my safe, the great big job, where I kept all the money. And one day, to my horror, I looked out from my cabin and the safe was open. And what had happened was the kids had been fiddling with the combination. Well, did that ever start a traumatic experience? I had to summon my henchmen, and we had to count all the cash. Fortunately, not a farthing was missing. I heaved a sigh of relief. We got into Liverpool.
How much money was in there?
Oh, there was a hell of a lot. It was only the other day that I burned my old cash book. There was thousands of pounds, all in one-pound notes. And there were bags of half-crowns and shillings and sixpences. One of the things that was good in the ship, which is in all American ships, there was an excellent laundry with good equipment. And I ran it as a commercial thing, and I charged people for their bloody laundry. Not very much, but some. And I put the money into the public funds. Nobody ever queried that, except when we got to Liverpool, some British paymaster captain came aboard and said, "Oh boy, we're going to take your laundry out. You'll be needing another storeroom." I said, "We've got all the storerooms we need, but we need the laundry." "Oh," he said, "nobody has a laundry now." I said, "Like a pig's ear. We have one, and it works one damn well." I said, "Come along, and I'll show you." I must say, the guy was quite impressed. We ran it with volunteer stokers and seamen. In Liverpool, we landed our women and children. Glad to see the last of them.
How many were there about?
There were about 25 children, I think, and about 15 adults. We sailed again. We went into Gladstone Dock to unload, and we sailed again. We went up to the Clyde, and we flew off our aircraft, and they went to the naval air station at Macrahanish. Yeah. And we were at the tail of the bank for a short time. And incidentally, when we were there, we met the Prince Henry, which at that time was commanded by but anyway, I had a lot of old friends on board, and I went over to have a drink with them, and they thought they'd be funny. She was in a landing ship at that point. They'd shot down a drogue target, and I was seized by a whole bunch of characters, stuffed into the drogue target, and they tied a knot at each end, and when my boat came to get me, I was carried down and dumped on board in the drogue. And they were having a party with a bunch of wrens on board, which was SOP. And I remember there was a great...
It's SOP.
You know, standard operating procedure.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a great thundering of feet down the alleyway that went... the wardroom, and a little wren looking very disheveled was being pursued by Val Godfrey. That was the captain. It was quite a do.
She fled into the wardroom for sanctuary?
I guess so.
It's not a good place.
Then we went back to Liverpool, and we were there for 6 weeks at the Alexandra Dock, doing a refit. The trouble was that the refit was being done by a lot of octogenarians, and one of the things that was required was to paint the ship with
dazzle camouflage.
Camouflage. And these birds were doing it with 3-inch paint brushes. So we said, well, look here, we can help you on this. We've got paint sprayers on board. Oh, no, we couldn't do that. The union wouldn't allow it. Well, then the other thing that happened was that they stole everything in sight. And if it wasn't nailed down or welded to the deck, they picked it up and took it away. So we said, all right, we're going to augment the gangway stuff, and we're going to search everybody. That was captain's orders. We did it once, you know, one day. And next morning, nobody turned up for work. And the admiral, flag officer Liverpool or something, came down next day to see the captain, and he said, look here. He said, you fellas have got to stop this. Because, he said, I want to get this ship out, and we'll have no more work done if you keep on doing this. Well, Nelson Lay said that they're robbing us blind. He said, you just have to accept it. The other thing was, you know, in an aircraft carrier especially, the rules about smoking and fire is taken pretty seriously, particularly in the hangar deck. Mm-hmm. These guys were breaking up packing cases and brewing their tea on little bonfires in the middle of a hangar.
I believe it.
Well, then, I suppose we were reasonably well looked after in Liverpool. The women's volunteer service were very much in evidence. They're mentioned in Lay's book here.
Yes.
I won't add my comments to it. I didn't take quite as a glorious view of them as he did. But, well, they laid on a certain amount. Various people laid on various entertainments for us, and we didn't have too bad a time. It rained most of the time. That was another amusing thing. Most of us wore oilskins and on occasion sou'westers. It was pretty wet. And Lay was coming on board one day and clad in an oilskin, the sou'wester, and some seaman came up behind and told him rather rudely to get the hell out of the way. So Lay sent for the painter, and his oilskin appeared next time he wore it with four stripes on the sleeves, Captain written in large letters on the back, and scrambled eggs painted on the sou'wester.
Not nice.
We left Liverpool, must have been the end of April, or into May by then, and we went up to the Clyde, got our aircraft back, and then we began workups in the western approaches. We went to Larne, and our aircraft exercised with submarines there, and they invited various ones of us to go and go to sea with them, which was quite interesting, and I went to sea in a submarine called the Spiteful, and found it very restful and pleasant way to go. We saw quite a bit of Belfast, which is an unattractive city in my book. Occupied Ireland, of course. We did exercises in the West Approaches I mentioned, and one night we were out and doing night flying, and one of our aircraft was up, and somehow or other he lost his horizon. It was a dirty night, and he went right into the sea, and he escaped with injuries, but not too serious. His two crewmen were lost because the charges went off and blew up the aircraft. The pilot was a chap called Don Cash, who, the last I saw of him, lived in Montreal. He was picked up by a destroyer we had as plane guard. I think it was a four-stack or two in our end one. And then we had our inspection by the flag officer carrier training. And that was, from his point of view, a disaster, because he fired the lieutenant commander flying, just like that. And apparently our squadron hadn't been properly worked up. And we got another one who was a much better chap. I didn't like the fellow that got fired. He was the most disloyal to the captain, and I could go on. I know he's gone to his reward, but he was a troublemaker.
Well, on the 17th of March, we can let it go by saying a bad cess to him.
Yeah. Then we we did some more workups, and then we were ordered up to Scapa Flow, where we joined the home fleet, and we went on shortly after that on Operation Offspring. You were there too.
Sue and Algonquin were there. I was in Sue.
Yeah. Was indefatigable and trumpeter. We went up and laid mines off the coast of the Lepsoy area and in the Norwegian Leeds.
Yes.
And then that was the 11th of August, 44. Then on the later in August, we went on Operation Goodwood, which you were also on. And with that time, we had formidable, furious, indefatigable, Nabob and Trumpeter, Duke of York, three or four cruisers, and a bunch of destroyers. And we were screened, the Trumpeter and Nabob were screened by EG-5, which the Bickerton was the senior ship.
Yes.
And we were supposed to clobber the Tirpitz. And if you remember...
That was April, is it?
No, that was the 22nd of August.
Because she had been clobbered in April.
Oh, yeah, people had been clobbering her for a long time, but by two-man submarines and... Well, air, the fleet air arm, and
in the April one, we caught her with her pants down at 5:30 on Monday morning, which seemed to me rather unsporting, seemed to us all. But ever after that, every other raid we went on, she filled the fjord with smoke,
right.
And they dropped their bombs into smoke and didn't do much damage.
Well, the 22nd of August, our
Sir Bruce Fraser has left as CNC now, has he not? And was that not?
It was Admiral Moore, wasn't it?
Admiral Moore, who was the one under Fraser, had moved up to Commander-in-Chief Home Fleet.
Yeah, and he was in Duke of York.
He was in Duke of York.
And in between the time we came home from Offspring and the mounting of Goodwood, we were sent down to Rosyth to pick up some new influence mines. And they were, the sophisticated pressure magnetic acoustic type. And they were terribly secret. Nobody was allowed to know anything about them. And there was only one fellow who knew anything about them anyway. A chap, he was the torpedo officer, and he was interesting in the fact that he had been sunk in the Edinburgh, no more from anything, a couple of years previously, or 3 years previously.
Yeah.
Anyway, the day that we were supposed to launch our attack, the 22nd, there was an overcast over the target area, although it was reasonably clear at sea, as you remember, and we had to abort our Avengers. Now, we were carrying 14 Avengers and 4 Wildcat 5 fighters for that exercise. And then that evening, we hauled off to refuel some of the destroyers. And the first one to come up to be refueled was the Norwegian Stord.
Yes.
We were just getting the hoses out to pump some fuel into her when we were hit on the starboard side by a torpedo, and one passed ahead, according to our ASDIC people. And there was a certain amount of consternation. I happened to be asleep at the time because I'd been up all the night before doing ciphers, and I just put my head down for about, I thought about half an hour or something while the fueling was going on. And of course I took off from my bunk and flew up about 18 inches. When we all gathered around the ladder going up to the hangar deck, fellow appeared beside me, dripping wet, absolutely stark naked. So I said, "What the hell have you been doing?" And at that point, we could hear the ship, breaking noises as bulkheads gave and everything. I knew the ship had stopped, and the alarm rattlers were going. He said, "Oh, I was taking a shower." Well, I said, "A bloody stupid time and place to take a shower." I said, "You're not going up Starco the way you are." And he said, "Oh, what can I do?" Well, I said, "You can go into my cabin and get some clothes. Help yourself." Well, then the other thing that came, a lot of people had their RCN type life jackets on, and they couldn't go through the manhole. So I had to call them all down, tell them to take their jackets off, go up, and put them on again. My action station was the after group of anti-aircraft guns. There were the Bofors and 6 Orlikans. So I went there, and just as I was going to sleep, they broadcast that one of the fighters, not one of ours, I think it was one from Trumpeter, had shot down a snooper, a Blaumann Voss. So we knew that the other fellows knew that we were there. And then, just after I got onto the upper deck, Bickerton crossed our bow. They were doing an operation called Observant, I think. And there was a hell of a gout of water and smoke and gubbins from her stern. We thought she'd dropped a pattern of depth charges, but it wasn't that she'd been hit in the propellers by an acoustic torpedo, which was actually fired at us to finish us off, but it got diverted by the noise of the... Our propellers had stopped by then, and they went off. It went off and hit the Bickerton. And her siren stuck, howling away, and the smoke apparatus on the
quarterdeck,
it all started to blow, and it was sucked into their ventilating system, and it was added to their trials and tribulations. Well, somebody went and picked up their people. I forget who it was. In the meantime, our problem was the damage control parties were busy at work under the senior engineer, who's a lieutenant commander, I guess he was, or was he a two-striper then, Denny Forster. And he was a real expert on damage control. And we had made a point of having three times more than our normal allowed establishment of timber. And this was a big help, because they were able to do a lot of shoring. The engine room, which in those ships was a combined engine room, we only had one turbine, one shaft. The boiler was in the engine room space. And, of course, they had to shut down the boiler. And because there was no electricity, no power, the fans weren't working. The temperature went up to 135 or something in the engine room, and they had to evacuate. But the fellow who was the electrical officer, his name was Dick Ross, Lieutenant Commander of VR, Canadian, he got the generators going again.
Is that the one that went up to Admiral?
No.
Another one, all right.
He was a wartime only,
yeah.
I think. He got the generators going, and that meant that the engine room people were able to get back inside, and also gave light where it was needed. And although the torpedo had hit aft of the after engine room bulkhead, it did not damage the shaft. It bent it a little bit, but it didn't. So they managed. By 9 o'clock in the evening, they were able to get steam up again, and they tried her, and we could rattle along at 5 or 6 knots.
May I go back a bit, please? Did you not? Were you not ordered by Sir Henry Moore? Was Nelson Lay not ordered by Sir Henry Moore that if he couldn't get going in a certain length of time to
abandon ship? Yes, that is so.
And what did Nelson Lay say?
Nelson Lay sent a very rude reply, saying he had no intention of abandoning his ship as long as until he found out whether he could steam it or not.
Right. Were not some of the crew of Nabob transferred?
Yes, the Kempthorne, which was one of the EG-5 captain class frigates, she came alongside the quarterdeck, and she took off 204, mostly fleet air arm. And I might add that the remainder of the fleet disappeared over the horizon in a hell of a hurry. There was a little poem that was written by some character. I don't know who it is, but I got a copy of it at the time, which I have amongst my souvenirs. One of the verses is, on the quarter deck we heard a mighty rush of feet. Fleet air.